Mr. Goldstein?
May it please the Court, my name is Jake Goldstein. I represent the plaintiff appellant, Maurice Jackson. We are here today to request that this Court reverse the entry of summary judgment in favor of Nurse Pullion and Counselor Ryan.
What research did you do into hypertension, either at the district court level? Did you represent?
I was not involved at the district court level, Your Honor.
Well, what research was performed, either by you or by your predecessor in the district court, on hypertension?
In terms of the seriousness of the condition, Your Honor?
Symptoms and what the normal range is, significance of age, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. Your Honor, at the district court level, during the deposition of Dr. Fuentes, who was the treating physician for Mr. Jackson here, she testified that the normal range for an individual of his age was 120 over 80.
That's not a range. That's a point.
I'm sorry. The normal point for an individual of his age is 120 over 80.
That's the optimal. That or a little below 120. That's the optimal blood pressure. But the top of the range is 140 over 90. I don't think, I mean, 140, it's borderline because it's the top. And the doctor might encourage you to, you know, have a somewhat lower, you know, less salt and so forth, more exercise. But I don't believe that people are ever treated for having a blood pressure of 140 over 90. So this fellow, 3 weeks after giving up his hydrochlorothiazide, he's got 142 over 86 or 84?
That's correct.
He's got a trivial elevation in blood pressure. And then isn't it true that a week later it was back down to 117, even though he hadn't resumed the hydrochlorothiazide yet?
It is true that his...
What is the medical basis for thinking that this temporary elevation, trivially above the normal range, could endanger his health, create headaches, nosebleeds? Those are very unusual. Symptoms of hypertension are rare. That's why it's called the silent killer. And it's true, you can get a headache and so on. But a young person with a very slight elevation? No, that's extremely unlikely.
So
where is some, you know, scientific evidence in the case?
We would posit, Your Honor, that Dr. Fuentes' testimony that his elevated blood pressure of 142 over 78, which she testified was an unacceptable level for somebody with that condition. And that it was...
But in what condition? Unacceptable for someone in what
Somebody
condition?
With the hypertension condition.
Wait a second. What are you talking about? What was his blood pressure before he started taking any medicine?
Your Honor, I don't know the answer to that.
Well, then how do you know how severe a problem he has?
I'm relying on Dr. Fuentes' testimony, Your Honor, where she said that that was an unacceptable level for him.
What does that mean? Is there something special about him that a normal blood pressure, say 140, would be dangerous for him, even though it's normal for everybody else?
Well, unfortunately, Your Honor, all I can go off of was Dr. Fuentes.
Well, it's not all you can go off of. You could do some research. You could look at the Mayo Clinic's website. If you Google Mayo Clinic hypertension, you will get detailed, authoritative information about hypertension, right? Rather than presenting us with something on its face highly implausible.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that the court also consider the case of Williams versus Liefer.
When you got this case, the first thing you should have known was that there was something very strange about making a big fuss about a temporary elevation, a very young person, of 142. Right? That's the first thing that you should strike you. Something very strange here. And you couldn't possibly prove anything without, you know, some kind of scientific, some kind of expert. Not as treating physician, an expert on hypertension.
Well, Your Honor, I would suggest that Dr. Fuentes, as a licensed physician, is could be considered an expert in that area.
Look, physicians are not experts in every... There's nobody who's an expert in every single area of medicine.
But she was prescribing the medication to him.
Look, primary care physicians prescribe... They actually know a fair amount about hypertension, and they prescribe blood pressure medication. That's fine. But if you have some really strange strange issue about hypertension, you go to the specialist in hypertension. Because, as I say, 142, it's trivially above the top of the normal range for this systolic reading, and to think that this might cause a serious problem for a person, that's so implausible. You've got to have an expert who says, yeah, believe it or not, had 142 for 6 weeks, I mean for 3 weeks, four weeks. Yeah, that could really cause problems. That's what you need.
Well, relying on the case of Williams versus Liefer, where you have...
It's not a matter of cases. This is a matter of science.
Unless the case was written by a specialist in hypertension.
It was not, Your Honor.
Who is the author of the case?
I could find it.
Have a medical degree? If you want to know medical facts, you turn to medical journals or you turn to medical websites, one would think.
This is true, but we can't escape the fact that hypertension is a condition that can lead to such serious results as stroke or death.
Look, a 25-year-old or whatever he is with 100, so for 3 weeks he has 142. That's not going to lead to a stroke or a heart attack unless he has some terrible weakness which makes normal or marginally above normal systolic reading dangerous to him. Now, maybe he does have some idiosyncratic condition, but there isn't any evidence of that.
I would first state that, Your Honor, the district court and at least one of defendants both conceded this issue, that this was an objectively serious medical condition.
The incidence of trial lawyers and people who argue in this court having high stress is enormous.
I'm under it right now, Your Honor.
I know you are. I was sympathizing with you and was going to offer you medicine if I had it.
So, while their concession certainly is not dispositive for the court's analysis, I think what's important here is we do have a dangerous medical condition. While it may not be dangerous in the same sense to Mr. Jackson as it would be to somebody of a greater age or a greater weight, it still is nonetheless a dangerous condition.
That's the question. That is not the answer.
Well, I think the answer, Your Honor, is that his procedures of notifying his treaters, or rather his counselor, that he had this, he was without his medication for this period of time, and that those requests were ignored, is...
Didn't he make some complaint about dandruff?
He made a complaint about dry scalp. That is correct.
Is he going to bring a lawsuit about that?
I don't know. I don't think so.
You know, we do have a problem. I'm sympathetic to the prisoners. They don't have much to keep them entertained. But there is a problem of prisoners who abuse the availability of various types of, you know, assistance like medical. And I just don't understand this lawsuit and this serious statement by you that it's a dangerous condition.
Your Honor, I see that my time has concluded.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Goldstein. Ms. Oshianza?
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. Assistant Attorney General Linda Boachianza on behalf of Defendant James Ryan. The District Court's judgment in favor of Ryan can be affirmed for four independent reasons. First, Jackson failed to establish that Ryan had a sufficiently culpable state of mind for an Eighth Amendment claim. As this Court ruled under analogous circumstances in Johnson v. Doty, a non-medical prison official's failure to respond to a single medical complaint is at most evidence of negligence, but not deliberate indifference. It's undisputed that Ryan did not respond to Jackson's grievance about his need for blood pressure medicine, but it's also undisputed that Jackson never told Ryan in person that he lacked blood pressure medicine, and Ryan didn't otherwise learn about this medical need in early 2009. In order to establish deliberate indifference, Jackson had to show that Ryan perceived but disregarded a serious risk to Jackson's health, and Jackson failed to make this showing. Second, the record demonstrates that Jackson either received or had access to care from the prison's medical staff throughout the 22-day period when he claims to have been without medicine. Jackson had medical appointments on February 17th, 27th, and March 3rd, and he could have requested additional medicine during any of these visits. The court has observed that non-medical prison officials generally will not be found deliberately indifferent for failing to respond to the medical complaints of a prisoner who already was being treated by the medical staff. And here, Jackson was being cared for by the medical staff and could have requested medicine at any time. Third, this court could affirm the judgment in favor of Ryan on the ground of qualified immunity. Ryan was not responsible for administering Jackson's medicine, and he didn't withhold medicine from Jackson. Therefore, the relevant inquiry for qualified immunity purposes is whether it was clearly established that Ryan's lack of response to the grievance violated a constitutional right. And this court's ruling in Johnson v. Doty shows that it was not clearly established that a grievance counselor's lack of response to a grievance violates the Constitution. Finally, when an inmate claims that a delay in medical treatment amounts to a constitutional violation, this court requires the inmate to present verifying medical evidence showing that the delay caused harm. And in this case, such evidence was not presented. Therefore, unless the court has any further questions, we ask that you affirm the judgment in favor of Ryan.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Boschianza. Mr. Elward?
Thank you. Brad Elward on behalf of Rashawn Napoleon. I think the comments that my co-counsel made have some applicability here to our case, just from the standpoint of in order to succeed against Ms. Polian, it was incumbent upon Jackson to show that she both perceived and disregarded a known substantial risk. And I think that's where this case fails. And what they're trying to do here in this case is they're trying to say because Jackson authored a request note, a call note, that's been called several things, but in essence wrote a note out supposedly directed to my client that said my blood pressure medicine is low and put it in a box, I think for the lack of better description, that somehow created a question of fact as to whether or not my client had notice and knowledge of this condition. And my client, of course, testified and was asked several different angles about whether or not she knew, whether she received the note, whether she had any knowledge whatsoever of the fact that Mr. Jackson did not have his current prescription or his current medications. And she said, no, I did not. And They're trying to say, simply because of that note, that there's some question of fact. And I think when we look at the case that they cited in their reply brief, and I'd like to address that just for a second because obviously we didn't have a chance to address it in our appellee brief, but when you look at the case they talk about in their reply brief, the thing that's missing from our case is that the plaintiff in that case specifically told the prison official, I'm worried about my cellmate. So we have that direct knowledge. Now, of course, that jail official said, no, I wasn't told of that. But the difference between that case and our case is we don't have Jackson telling Polian, hey, I need more medications, mine ran out, and her saying no. That's a classic question of fact that you see all the time, and certainly would rise to the level of something that would pass to the jury. Here, we don't have that connection. If you make a reference to like an evidentiary scenario, you have a chain of custody type argument that could be applied here. You know, you look at the deposition of this plaintiff and you say, where's the call nurse? Where are the policies of this jail that establish what the procedures are from the drop box to the individual that the note is addressed to? We don't have any of that information here. There's nothing that connects that note going in a box to my client. And I think that's what the district court looked at here and said there's no evidence that shows in any capacity that she knew of this condition. And again, the condition isn't the fact that this gentleman had a high blood pressure condition. The issue here is knowledge of high blood pressure condition without medication for that condition. I think that's why they can't simply point to the fact, well, she knew that he had high blood pressure. She wrote the prescription. That should be enough. That's very different than me looking at you, Your Honor, and seeing you in a condition of some type of injury and ignoring it. Because I can look at that and say, ah, he's hurt, he needs help, and I'm ignoring it. We don't have that here because what's missing is a knowledge of the lack of the medications. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. So, Mr. Golson, your time had expired, but we'll give you another minute because your opponents addressed the issues that you weren't able to address in your opening argument.
Thank you very much, Judge, for the extra time. I will be brief. Turning to Counselor Ryan's argument about that there was no verifiable medical evidence to establish that there some harm was caused, I think that while the elevated blood pressure reading was slightly elevated, that certainly establishes that there was some harm involved in the delay of providing Mr. Jackson with his much-needed heart medication. Also, turning to the argument by Counselor Ryan's counsel about the access to medical care, it sounds to me that she is making the argument that it is the period of delay that is relevant in this situation. In other words, that because he had access to medical care over the course of this three-week period, then her client is obviated of any responsibility to respond to his grievances. And in the case that I wanted to talk about very quickly was the Williams versus Lifer case, where you have a six-hour delay in providing pain and heart medication. And that was sufficient in that case. And the jury found in favor of the plaintiff in that case. This court affirmed that jury's verdict, finding that six-hour delay was sufficient. And with that, Your Honor, unless the court has any questions, we would ask that this court reverse the entry of summary judgment in favor of Nurse Polian and Counselor Ryan and remand for a trial on these issues. Thank you.
And were you pro bono?
I was, Your Honor.
Okay, well, we thank you for undertaking the assignment. We thank the defense lawyers.